Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Satellite images show a rare flooding in the Moroccan Sahara Desert. We'll hear an expert opinion on what's happening to the largest hot desert in the world.
This significant event of heavy rainfall in the east of Morocco, specifically the one that happened recently in the past 2 days in the Sahara Desert, is actually due to a typical meteorological phenomenon involving an extratropical cyclone. During this period, some places in the southeast of Morocco experienced like a heavy rainfall.
And a community in Uganda where most people are visually impaired.
Lubu community is a community of people that are living with visual impairment or blindness. There are around 25 people, adults, who are visually impaired and also children. So it's like the whole area of Lubu has more people who are visually impaired than many other areas in eastern Uganda.
It's Thursday, October 10th. First, we go to Zimbabwe. It was once known as the breadbasket of Africa, but ownership of land is one of the most topical and controversial issues in Zimbabwe. The controversy dates back to the colonial times, but has over the years continued as governments try to implement what they think is right. One of those policies was the Fast Track Land Reform Program, launched by former President Robert Mugabe in the year 2000. Under the program, Zimbabwe forcibly took land acquired by white farmers during the colonial era and leased it back to black farmers. Our correspondent will give us more details about that, but fast forward to today, the government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa has announced a compensation program for those who lost their land under the Mugabe policy. At the same time, the lease agreements given to black farmers will be replaced with permanent land titles, giving them outright ownership of the properties. Here is the BBC's Shingai Nyoka, who started by giving us the context.
How did the white farmers acquire this land in the first place?
Well, it was through the ancestors, largely the colonialists. In this case, it was Cecil John Rhodes in the late 1800s, came up from South Africa and decided that Zimbabwean land was good. The land was largely fertile and was good for agriculture and also for mining. And so that really set in motion the takeover of land from the locals that were there at the time. And the takeovers were violent. There were hut taxes. And so for about 90 years that prevailed until Zimbabwe went to war against the colonial government and won that war. And one of the key policies, one of the key reasons that they went to the war was to be able to get back the land that had been taken.
Something happened in the year 2000 then, because the then president, Robert Mugabe, came up with this fast track land reform program. How was it executed?
Initially, at the time, they were called land-hungry people when they first started taking over the farms because they were frustrated at the pace at which the government was buying the farms and resettling them. Robert Mugabe's government arrested them, but then just for political reasons, they would allow people that were taking over the farms to do so. And what followed was really a violent takeover of those farms where the white farmers were kicked off sometimes overnight with just the clothes on their back.
So the farmers that were affected, the white farmers, were they compensated at the time, or was there at least any plan to do that?
At the time, there was a lot of rhetoric that there would be no compensation because, after all, they stole the land. But with a lot of political pressure from Europe and America, essentially the Western countries, Robert Mugabe, the then president, changed his rhetoric to say that they would pay for the improvements on the land and not for the land itself. There really were no major efforts in the same way that has happened under this current government to pay that compensation for the improvements. But there are a lot of different types of farmers. There were what the foreign farmers that were protected under bilateral protection agreements. And so those really were a priority for President Robert Mugabe to compensate, even though that hasn't happened to the extent that the farmers would like to.
So, Shingai, you've told us that under Mugabe there was just a lot of rhetoric about compensation, which did not happen for the most part. Why is it that the current president, Mnangagwa, has made the decision to compensate?
It's a very political matter, and the fact is that the Western countries have put a lot of pressure on Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe was essentially isolated economically with sanctions after the violent takeover of those farms. And so to be able to re-engage with the Western countries, one of the requirements is that Zimbabwe pays the compensation that it has promised to. And so what we've seen since 2020 is that the Zimbabwe government signed what was called a global political agreement, compensation agreement with the white farmers to the tune of $3.5 billion. But I must say that that hasn't really materialized. Zimbabwe is still trying to decide how it's going to finance it because it's still a really controversial topic. Not a lot of people believe that the government should even be paying compensation for the improvements.
Shingai, talk to us then about this new land ownership policy where the black farmers will be able to get permanent title deeds.
Well, one of the things over the last 25 years is that when the government seized the land, they decided that they would retain ownership of the land that had been taken and that the black farmers would receive 99-year leases and what the government has called offer letters. But that has had its own set of problems. So what the government has decided is that they want to change the policy, and this comes after a lot of lobbying from the farmers. And so they are saying that instead of the limited term title, they want to now give permanent ownership of the land. They're describing it not as a title deed, but as a document that's bankable, transferable, and registrable. It remains to be seen whether that document will, in effect, be accepted by the banks.
Is the main thing that then the farmers feel they need to be able to use this title for what exactly? Why do they feel they really need it?
Essentially, it's for financing. A lot of them didn't have collateral on their own. They didn't have title deeds. So they didn't own homes. And so they really weren't able to put up any kind of collateral that's required to run a successful farming enterprise. The other issue is that because the title, the 99-year leases, were rather tenuous. The farmers really didn't invest long-term infrastructure into the ground because they weren't sure whether they'd be able to hold on to those farms. And so making this title permanent, allowing it to be transferable to their children, for example, it's easier, the government believes, for the banks to be able to loan the farmers and to give them the confidence that they are settled on this land permanently and they can actually start investing in it.
Right. So this seizure of land then under Mugabe's leadership had a negative impact on the country's economy and politically. Just explain to us how bad it was.
Well, the largest impact were the economic sanctions, where Western countries, which formed really the backbone of Zimbabwe's economy, the export markets, whether it was to Europe and the European Union and Britain and the US and Australia, all of those lines were cut off. Agriculture, which was the backbone of the economy, collapsed. And so we've seen as a result of that, economic collapse across the board, where the exchange rate has collapsed. All of the goods and services, all of the goods in particular that Zimbabwe used to produce. If you drive around the countryside, many, many farms that used to be productive are just lying fallow. There isn't a lot of production happening on them. And so I think the idea is, as the government says, is to unlock the value the title from the ownership of the farm in order of the farms to be able to ramp up the agricultural production.
Shingai, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The BBC's Shingai Nyoka in Harare. And now, in the vast sun-baked stretches of Morocco's Sahara Desert regions, something unexpected has happened. Heavy rains that fell in the months of August and September have given life to a landscape more accustomed to drought. Imagine the sand valleys and dunes in a place where temperatures soar and rainfall is scarce, suddenly transformed into lagoons. One lake, called Lake Iriqui, has been dry for over 50 years and now has sprung back to life. Experts say these recent events could change the Sahara Desert's climate for years to come. To understand why this is happening, I've been speaking with Fatna Ikram, an environmental engineer and co-founder of Youth for Climate in Morocco.
This significant event of heavy rainfall in the east of Morocco, specifically the one happened recently in the past 2 days in the Sahara Desert, is actually due to a typical meteorological phenomenon involving an extratropical cyclone. So during this period, some places in the southeast of Morocco experienced like a heavy rainfall. And this is actually beyond the annual average. And this is actually a remarkable event in this region. For example, if we take like Tata as one of, you know, the most affected region, usually gets under 250 millimeters of precipitation per year, although this actually, you know, uncreated a substantial rainfall during this this interval. So according to Morocco's General Directorate of Meteorology, they indicate that such intense precipitation over a brief period has not occurred in 30 or to 50 years. So this event, the extratropical storm, introduced like humid air that interacted with the arid desert environment, and this actually results in heavy precipitation. Like experts said that climate change also can or may contribute by augmenting air moisture, hence raising like likelihood of severe weather occurrence.
And how does this change then with more rainfall coming to the area? How does this, you know, change life for the local communities there?
Well, this unusual events and this intense precipitation presents like both prospects and obstacles for local communities. So the plentiful water is expected to recharge actually significant groundwater aquifers under the desert, which are essential actually for water supply in these regions that suffer from water scarcity. And the abrupt and the severe precipitation also resulted in other catastrophic in like flash floods and like over 20 individuals died due to this event, and also the agriculture yields were compromised. So the Moroccan government was compelled to disperse emergency assistance funding, especially for regions like for the southern regions that still, you know, recuperating from the last year's earthquake. So, the infrastructure, residents and the agriculture also were adversely affected, and the communities comfort the urgent challenge of reconstruction and recovery from these events.
Right. And what about the environment? What are some of the potential ecological consequences of this? Because I would assume, you know, the organisms or the animals and the vegetation in the desert was sort of used to that desert life. But now there's water.
Yeah, there was like potential ecological consequence because the sudden influx of water has the potential to disrupt the life cycle of desert adapted species and introduce invasive species that compete with the native flora and fauna. So yeah, the subsequent dehydrating process could result in the die off organisms that have colonized this area, is potentially causing like ecological imbalances.
And I'm wondering if this phenomenon is also being experienced in other countries as well, where the Sahara Desert cuts across.
Yes, there was like other countries that suffer or they experience the same events and the same consequences, such as Nigeria and Sudan, due to the heavy rainfall that actually led to the floods in the region. So, this is actually unexpected events in such an areas that they suffer from, you know, extreme weather due to the climate change.
Ikram, then, is this now the new normal? Are the authorities expecting that this will happen every now and then, that we're going to have much more rain in southeast Morocco, in a part that is known to be a desert?
It's a little bit actually difficult to predict with certainty, but like possibly that the such rare events could become more frequent than they have been in the past years or in the past decades. So instead of being events that happen once, like every few decades, we might see them occurring at shorter intervals. And this doesn't guarantee that the region will experience the same level of rainfall regularly, but it suggests that extreme weather events could become like less uncommon. So predicting the exact timing of such events require like detailed climate modeling and continuous monitoring of weather patterns. So scientists actually and meteorologists are working to understand how climate change affects regional climates to improve the accuracy of such prediction in this region. And at the same time, it will be prudent for local communities and authorities to prepare to have like frequent extreme weather events like these, both to mitigate potential risks and to take advantage of any benefits such as increased water availability.
All right. Thank you very much for your time, Ikram.
Thank you.
Fatna Ikram, an environmental engineer from Morocco. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohamed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
To Uganda now, in a remote community called Lubu, along the shores of Lake Victoria. Nearly all residents there are either blind or visually impaired. The situation is made worse by a lack of enough medical care, and most of those affected hardly get to know the cause of the blindness. In Uganda, more than 3 million people suffer from loss of sight, according to the International Agency for the Prevention of Blindness. The BBC's Agnes Penda visited this community and joined me to talk about life there. Okay, Agnes, welcome to the Focus on Africa podcast. Could you start by telling me about this community that you visited and what makes them so special?
Lubu community is a community of people that are living with visual impairment or blindness. There are around 25 people, adults who are visually impaired, and also children amongst this community. So it's like the whole area of Lubu has more people who are visually impaired than many other areas in eastern Uganda.
When you got there, what did you see? How is it that they carry their business around?
They love each other. This is a community that is very tight-knit. They have meetings every Monday. They discuss issues to do with their families. They discuss to do with education of their children. They discuss health. So they do everything together, really.
We formed the Lubu Blind Group after realizing that the town was isolating us just because we are blind. We face a lot of challenges, from thieves who target us because of our disability to unfair treatment when it comes to dividing family assets. And for some of us, finding a marriage partner is difficult. We talk about how we can support ourselves and keep our children in school, how we can feed and clothe them.
So it's a very tight community. There's a lot of love. So you may not even notice that people are visually impaired from the way they're talking, they're communicating, they're laughing together, singing together. So it's quite a joyful community, really.
And how do they fit, these 25 people that have formed a community, how do they fit in the general village of this place that you visited?
So Lubu was once a school for the blind. And some of them decided to stay on after the school was closed. There was once a disease called river blindness, which is still there, but then that time there were very many cases in the early 2000s. So after some time, the disease was eradicated from the area, or there are now fewer cases. But then some people stayed on in the school and they continued this community. So the people around them, they interact pretty well. But also what I discovered is that there are also people who are visually impaired around the community that is around them. So it's not strange for someone to see somebody who is visually impaired and for them to talk together and be as a community as a whole. So there's this cohesion where they just fit in with everybody else, really.
And what are the reasons behind such a high rate of blindness in the village and in this specific community?
So apart from river blindness, which was there in the early 2000s, and some people that were blind at that time are still blind. So there are other causes like trachoma, glaucoma. There is also high blood pressure, according to the doctors that we visited in the area that have been seeing these people in Lubu. They're talking about those as the causes of blindness in the area, and especially the issue of people not being able to access medical care. There wasn't much happening on the ground. What we found is that people are even struggling to find doctors. There's only one doctor for the whole county, one specialist that is looking after all these people when they have issues with their eyes. The people really just want to have more health care, more people on the ground to assist them, more doctors or even more dispensaries, because they found that one dispensary is quite far. It's in the next town. There's only just that one doctor that we spoke to that is able to handle all that big group of people. So there isn't really so much that we can say is being done apart from just people visiting the local dispensary and seeing if there's something that they can get.
What then is the government doing about the issue of blindness in Uganda as a whole? And are there steps that are being taken to sort of improve eye care services? Because you say this place is quite remote. It's in a rural setting. What's the government doing to help them?
The place is in a rural setting, and also there are very few eye doctors or eye specialists in Uganda. When he spoke to a government official in Kampala, he spoke about how the government is planning in financing higher education for doctors so that they can be able to study and they can have more specialists, especially in the issue of eye care.
We are training doctors. The government is encouraging many doctors to go for masters in ophthalmology, that they can become a specialist in eye care. As I talk now, there's still scholarship. Scholarship, government puts actually money there. People to go and study for free. Government pays for you to go and do masters or specialize in eye care.
They wish to have more doctors in those areas, and also they're planning to have more outreaches to be able to go to the ground and talk to the people so that they can be able to get them the right medication. Though this, they say, does not happen often. So that is one of the things that they say they're going to be doing more often, so to ensure that there are less people who have eye problems in that part of Uganda.
And are there, you know, some hopes and aspirations of this Lubu community moving forward? What did they tell you about that?
Oh, yes. They're very hopeful. One of the things that makes them very happy is that they're saying they're hoping for a very good future for their children. I spoke with Moses Mugave, who is the group leader, and was talking about how he wishes his children to go for higher education, and this is what he had to say.
The only hope and prayer I have for my children, I want them to complete their education. I need them to graduate with degrees, masters, and even PhDs. When they're educated enough, nobody will notice that they are blind. People will look at their achievements, and they'll be a source of inspiration for others.
And that's the voice of Moses Mugave, who's a community leader in Lubu. So, Agnes, you've mentioned sort of the medical conditions that you heard from the community and the medical doctors, but are there other reasons that could lead to these things that you found out that make blindness so prevalent?
From what we heard from the doctor that we visited in Mayuge town, that is a few kilometers away, those are the ones that they were able to give us. Although in the community people were saying that, or they feel like this thing could be hereditary, but when you speak to the doctor, he says this is not. And in fact, the main reason why it's going to the extent that it's going, that people are getting blind, is because when they fall sick, they do not go to the hospital immediately, or they use traditional medication. So that one makes the eyesight worse.
I'm sure sure there are many other places, many other communities, either in Uganda or other African countries where people, you know, medical care is not the best for, you know, eyesight, for other diseases as well. Do people sort of think something else could be linked to this? Because it does sound like a bit of an unusual situation, not what you're used to walk into a community where you have so many people suffering from visual impairment.
So people are talking about it could be witchcraft. That is one of the things that the doctors are saying is delaying medication. When someone believes it's witchcraft, they run to the witch doctor. They're given a concoction to put on their eyes, and then that could even affect the eyes further.
Right. And therefore, what are some of the most pressing challenges that the residents shared with you, especially, you just mentioned it, access to healthcare, but what about other things like education?
The schools are far. To get a school that has children who are visually impaired and they can fit in comfortably is more like you travel to a whole different town, and then the road network is not very good. It's quite remote. So there's those challenges of getting education for their children. They're also talking about economic challenges, finances being hard to come by, the projects which are not working right now that used to finance them. And then, so they're talking about struggles maybe of not being able to fund education for their children. That is actually one of the biggest challenges that they're facing as a community. So they're struggling a lot on that. That's what they talked about the most, that they really want their children to go to school and to do better in life, but then they're struggling to find school fees and other ways to assist them. So that was what came up the most, the finances.
Right. You spent time with this community. Could you share a particular moment that you felt was moving, or a story that you found in Lubu that stood out to you?
What I saw that was really interesting is how everyone's child is everyone's child. One person's child is everybody's child. Like, children in the community are ready to help anyone. And if an adult wants to go to a place or to their house, they just grab anyone who is near them to assist them to walk there. So I found this to be very interesting. If you compare to maybe other areas, you wouldn't just send anyone or ask anyone to assist you. So they are really close, and then you won't even notice that they are visually impaired until you look at them. So life just goes on as normal. They cook. They do everything that they're supposed to. They do to get by. And you won't notice that unless you look at someone and how they're walking. You won't really know that these people are visually impaired. And the joy that they have is what touched me the most.
Maybe, Penda, as you close for us, what really drove you to do this story, to go to Uganda and do this story?
I was just going through some research I was working on for disability, and I found out that there's a group of people that are actually visually impaired. And I found out this is a very special group, and I really was drawn to them. I wanted to know, find out how do they live together, what happens amongst them, how do they navigate life. So that is why I decided to actually do this story, and why not visit them and just find out for myself how it is like to live in Lubu. So that is what inspired me.
Thank you for your time, Agnes.
Thank you so much.
The BBC's Agnes Penda. Focus on Africa was put together by Yvette Twagira Maria, Nyasha Michelle, Rukia Bole, and Bella Hassan in London. The senior producer was Paul Bachibinga, and Francesca Dan was the technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again soon.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.